From the Sky News Centre at 5, a post-mortem examination is due to take place this afternoon on the body of a six-year-old girl who died at a New Forest campsite in the early hours. Two people have been arrested and are being questioned by police. Many people are said to be leaving the campsite because of the sombre mood. This woman was woken by the sound of screams and someone repeatedly pressing a car horn.
I saw the police cars coming up, but then I heard a woman screaming, but like she was talking within the scream, and because the ambulance was there quite a while, you know, I said, oh, I don't think that looks very good, because obviously it didn't go straight off. It was there quite a while.
Cigarettes can no longer be displayed in all large shops and supermarkets in England in a new effort to cut smoking. The legislation means tobacco products must now stay hidden in closed cupboards. The French Interior Minister says he fears a serial killer is on the loose after a series of murders in an outer suburb of Paris. Claude Jeon says maximum resources will be used to find the perpetrator. Investigators are looking into four murders that have taken place in the Essonne region of the capital since November. All victims were shot with the same kind of weapon. The Police Service of Northern Ireland has suspended four officers after the discovery of text messages which it's claimed were racist and sectarian. We're told the allegedly offensive texts were discovered during the course of a separate internal inquiry. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is
our community.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news this Good Friday is Regional Vice Chair of the Public and Commercial Services Union, that is the PCS, John McAnally. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we peer right down into the rabbit hole to ask, were the Nazis really defeated in 1945? Or did they just take off their uniforms and saunter into Civvy Street? And we look at the latest revelations about North Somerset MP Liam Fox's tainted term as Defence Secretary, his relationship with Adam Werrity, and a Harrier sale which instantly lost the taxpayer nearly £500 million. Plus a regime in Sri Lanka he was supporting whose army have killed tens of thousands of innocent Tamil civilians in 2009's race hate massacre. Also, the summer's London Olympics. We hear how the top mafia will be keeping the middle mafia out of London. And if you're a blogger, how to beef up your content by turning yourself into a people's spy. Author David Southwell explains how easy it is and what he found out spying on a meeting at Chequers with Tony Blair. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, for the bank holiday weekend, tonight lows of 6 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 13 Celsius, cloudy with a little rain. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week with some showers, some sunny spells, especially midweek. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of April, highs of 10 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Regional Vice Chair of the Public and Commercial Services Union, that's the PCS, John McAnally. Hi, John. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, how you doing?
First of all, John, what brought you into a union? Why did you join the union?
Can I just make one correction, if you don't mind, Tony? I'm actually National Vice President. Of PCS. The reason is I don't want to upset the Regional Vice Chair.
Oh, right, okay.
By stealing his or her position. Well, the reason I came into trade unionism is because I felt it was very, very important that workers need to be properly represented, that they needed to defend their rights in terms of in tax from the employers or the government in order to maintain wage levels or improve them, to defend the terms and conditions. And I think that's the reason why most people do actually join the unions. And I think that being a part of a union and being a union activist has never been more important.
The trouble is, though, of course, that this can affect the way a business is able to operate. A lot of the time, it's much better to put the control of a business in the hands of the people who own it. Then they can decide what's the best thing to do. Now, they may want to do something with the business or within a public service, for example, the unions are standing in the way of that, and it makes it actually very slow to manage. It makes it difficult to manage and slow to change.
Yeah, that's absolutely wrong. The fact of the matter is the efficiency of the public services, the effectiveness, and even the cost of the public services is based upon effective trade unionism. Look, the fact of the matter is, at the moment, Tony, we're going through a situation where we're seeing the biggest cuts programme in British history, which represents an absolutely massive transfer of wealth and power from ordinary people to the tiny 1%, as the Americans say, the tiny elite of business people within society. And the only voice, the only effective voice that's really speaking out against this at the present time is actually the trade union movement. So being a trade union is not just about defending terms and conditions. I would argue that at the present time, that trade unionism is absolutely vital to defending democracy in this country. I would put it as strongly as
well,
that.
Well, hang on a minute, because we all elected David Cameron and Nick Clegg to run the country, and the unions are trying to stop them doing what they were elected to do, which is to cut.
Well, first of all, we all didn't elect David Cameron, and Cameron never got a majority. He's using the Liberals as a human shield to carry through a programme of cuts, which has got absolutely no mandate for it. Let me give you one example. In terms of the privatisation programme, there is no mandate whatsoever for the privatisation of the NHS or education. On the question of welfare, we're seeing the removal of the safety net, which I think was there in terms of a social consensus that we don't want to see people living in absolute poverty. That is being removed. This country has been turned into a very, very brutal place, and there is no mandate for it whatsoever. What's happening is abuse of power, and that's what we're speaking out against.
Well, I'm sorry to contradict you, but actually the Conservatives, particularly David Cameron, not so much Nick Clegg, certainly did get elected on the idea of cutting more than the Labour Party were going to do. So, you know, effectively they've got to try and pursue that, and you're trying to stop them.
One actual fact we have in this country, whether it be Blair or Cameron, who are virtually indistinguishable, is politicians not saying in plain language what they're going to do. He did not get elected on the basis of cutting. He got elected, so say, on the basis of dealing with the deficit. Now, if he wanted to deal with the deficit, all he had to do, as Bob Crowe has said, the General Secretary of RMT, is put a penny on every tax, on every text message that's sent in this country, and that would clear the deficit tomorrow morning. What in actual fact they're doing is using a process of shock and awe to use the cover of a crisis that their friends actually created, people like them created, in order to drive through a privatisation and cuts programme which gives them more wealth and power. And if you want any kind of example of that, you just have to look at the recent budget where they cut the 50 pence tax rate for the rich, and are cutting at the same time as making life a damn sight more expensive for the average person.
Your union, how big is it? How many members do you have?
There's about 300,000 members.
Well, that's actually
civil servants.
Bigger than the political parties, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. And when you're making decisions about policy, how does that happen at the union?
Well, we consult with our members. As you're probably aware, in terms of, I guess that the question we go around to questions of industrial action, and how do we decide that? Well, we decide and on the basis of the most regulated system in the Western world, the tightest trade union laws, which mean that we have to jump through hoops in order to get to an industrial action ballot in the first place. But when we do, we actually go out and we consult our members. We consult them by meeting with them through various other methods, and if only Parliament was quite as democratic as the trade unions.
OK, we're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, we've heard this week that China is considering now privatising its state banks.
Well, I only heard that this afternoon. I mean, it seems a pretty silly thing to do to me. I mean, the one thing that's kept them afloat is that they weren't in the same mess as everybody else because they had a state banking system.
Well, since demand in the West is collapsing, do you think maybe that this is a reaction within China? They're thinking, well, if we privatise our banks, maybe we can deal with the economic woes we're suffering. But actually, the economic woes are coming from outside, not from inside.
China has got economic problems similar to those that we've got. but privatising their banks I don't think is a very sensible idea at all. But I can imagine there's a power struggle going on within the Communist Party about the direction of the Chinese economy. Some people, like Bo Xilar, this guy that's been forced out, he's been even accused of being a Maoist. I think he's just saying, look, we need to keep the socialist aspects of our system solid. Other people in the Communist Party, don't forget the Communist Party has millionaires in it in China. It's not just that, you know, it's not made of workers and peasants anymore. It's the ruling class. And the one wing of the ruling class is saying, well, let's just jump in with the West, and, you know, perhaps that will turbocharge our capitalism further, and we'll make more money, etc.
So what will be the thinking behind actually privatising the banking system? Because we've seen over here, they can't really be looking at the British, at the City and at Wall Street, and saying, oh, well, that looks like a good idea. Let's privatise our banks.
Well, do you know what? I think their state-owned banks have got loads and loads of rubbish on their books, just as our banks have, and you can't privatise what's worth nothing. They're probably bust.
So they will want to privatise them, and you don't think they will be able to succeed?
Who wants to buy a bust bank?
I certainly don't.
No, I don't either.
Okay, on to our first story this week, anyway. And this is from The Independent. Cuts are hampering a fight against crime, warns the Serious Fraud Office director. The outgoing director of the Serious Fraud Office expressed serious concerns last night that government cutbacks to the department's budget will hamper its efforts to tackle major white-collar crime. The SFO is often criticised for not prosecuting enough fraudsters. Mr Alderman, who's the outgoing chief, repeated his calls for a law that could successfully be used to prosecute the main players behind the banking crime, where convictions have been practically non-existent. What we need, he said, is a new law that would cover recklessly running a financial institution, he said. It's not that I want to put people behind bars, but a new offence will improve corporate behaviour, just like the Bribery Act has improved corporate behaviour previously. John?
Well, of course, it's certain members in the Ministry of Justice that helped administer the justice system generally. I notice you. I haven't actually read this story, but I notice your light's on the question of white collar crime, which is very, very interesting. I don't think the people in charge of this country at the present time are interested in prosecuting the people and near criminal behaviour actually that took place in the banks that actually led to the economic difficulties, or indeed some of the criminal behaviour that's actually going on in terms of the privatised sectors of that were once in the public sector itself. But beneath this is a really, really serious story, because what we're seeing in terms of the cuts, these ideologically driven cuts, which take no heed whatsoever of the impact on society, has got incredibly serious implications for justice and access to justice, because they're talking about closing hundreds of courts up and down the country, which means that people, when I talk about access, I mean actually directly physical access to justice. They're talking about and have in some cases privatised debt collection, a collection of fines and so on. We have a situation where underneath all this kind of fluff about ambulance chasing lawyers and that which is supposed to be wrong, which, you know, I suppose there's some truth in that, what they're looking at is a tax on employment law, where people who are treated badly at work won't be the rights they have at the present time, which are minimal, will be taken away from them. So it goes back to the original point, Tony. These cuts in terms of justice or welfare or anywhere else are going to fundamentally change the nature of this country, and it's going to be about taking away people's rights to justice and denying people's rights to pursue grievances, whether it be against employers or even in the criminal justice system itself.
Well, Martin, the Serious Fraud Office, we're told in this Independent article, handles the most serious and complex cases of fraud, which by their nature are the hardest and costliest to prosecute. He said, adding, cases get bigger and bigger all the time and more complicated. I'm seriously worried the SFO will have difficulty dealing with more cases and even smaller amounts of money. The Serious Fraud Office's budget for last year, revealed in its annual review published this week, was 30 £36.8 million. However, through its prosecutions, it recovered more than £50 million worth of assets from the proceeds of crime, up to the £42.5 million the previous year. Among those were the £29.5 million paid by BAE Systems towards educational projects in Tanzania after it reached a controversial settlement with the Serious Fraud Office over a major contract there. Martin, it seems like this organisation, the ESFO, is actually raising more money than it costs.
Indeed, and the same is true of the tax people, is it not? So when you've got all these people chasing people on benefits, in fact, you never get the money back because they haven't got any. But so if you've got tax collectors and fraud officers, they pay for themselves many times over. So this is clearly a politically motivated attempt to cover the backs of the people who fund the Conservative Party.
Could I just make a point on that in terms of so-called benefit fraud? The figure that the government uses is actually contentious, but they say there's about £1 billion is lost in fraud. What they don't say is there's £16 billion in unclaimed benefits. And the point that Martin makes is absolutely correct. That at the moment that they are cutting tax officers who are very cost-effective, to use the language of Cameron, in terms of bringing in tax, but that's not what they're interested in. So from that point of view, they're just interested in driving through these ideological cuts.
When you say ideological, what's the ideology behind it? What is this great ideal future?
Well, really what we have in terms of this government, I'm sorry to use this kind of language, but they are free market extremists. I'll give you an example of this. There's a very good book by American activist Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine. She described what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where the big companies in America, the same ones who are actually involved in Iraq and so on, and private contracts there, instead of rebuilding that community after that natural disaster, used it as an excuse to privatise anything that moved, to smash the unions and to drive the poor out of the city. Now, under the cover of this economic crisis, what people like Cameron and Osborne are trying to do is to drive through as much privatisation as they possibly can, because in reality it's not a question of there's no money around. There's plenty of money around. It's just that the big companies won't spend it at the present time because they don't get a big enough return of profit. So they're looking at the public sector. They see that as an easy way of making profit, and that is essentially what it's all about.
OK, moving on to another story then. The Leveson inquiry. Keir Starmer appears this week. Today's key witness, this is from a couple of days ago, was the Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer. And Keir Starmer was asked about the Metropolitan Police's Assistant Commissioner John Yates' statement about phone hacking, which he made on the 9th of July 2009. And he said, where there was clear evidence that people had been the subject of phone tapping, they were all contacted by the police. This case has been the subject of the most careful investigations by my most experienced detectives. No additional evidence has come to light since this case has concluded. Now, that was a statement in 2009. Things have moved a long, long way since then, and obviously John Yates has resigned. And Yates was saying, I therefore consider no further investigation is required. Keir Starmer said he had limited information at the time and took Yates' statement at face value. Essentially, he's saying, Martin, that there was pushback from John Yates over the hacking inquiry, and he was one of the major reasons why, even though they had a lot of evidence that people's phones had been being hacked, that nothing was actually done about it.
Yeah, well, we all know criminals lie, don't we? And maybe Mr. Yates is a criminal, even though he's a police officer.
What about the fact that he's now resigned? Because he's not even in the country now, is he?
You know what he's doing now? He's running the police in Bahrain.
Yeah.
Well, he's being an advisor to in Bahrain. The idea being, of course, that the Bahrainis have actually been really brutal with their people and putting down the uprisings there, and that he's over there to advise them.
Yeah, and one of the things he was saying is that peaceful protesters were extremists. I think, you see, we're going to hear David Southwell in the second hour, and he gave a very good talk. I saw him when he gave the talk. About, you know, and my uncle was a police officer, and I know police officers. One of the major problems you've got is some coppers are bent, and they've got their fingers in the till, and they're working for criminals. What's coming out is that criminals are able to buy getting their files deleted and stuff of that sort. I mean, David Cameron, one of the few things he said he did agree with, he said I can see no circumstances where it would be right for police officers to take money from outside people. And a lot of them do, but that means they are criminals. And the law, if the law is going to be upheld in this country, it's got to be upheld against the powerful. They've seen to be upheld.
John, this statement by John Yates, I therefore consider no further investigation is required. It's quite clear from what Keir Starmer's saying here and from John Yates' statement that Yates himself was one of the major people pushing back to make sure that there was no actual inquiry with all this evidence, prima facie evidence, of phone hacking going on.
Millions of people in this country are doing their best to just get along and survive in very difficult times. And what's happened around the Murdoch-Levinson situation is it's been exposed that in the top ranks of the police, the press and politicians work together. See, I wouldn't call that a conspiracy. If everybody thinks the same, it's not a conspiracy. They see their role as protecting corporate interests. Now, I mean, whether John Yates is a criminal or not is something that people can judge. But the fact of the matter is, he very clearly had the wherewithal to pursue this in a serious way, and he didn't. And the reason that he didn't was because that he and others high up in the police had an unhealthy and I would go as far as to say a potentially corrupt relationship with these big news corporations, you know, the Murdoch corporations. And it's absolutely unacceptable. So what we need is a democratic, accountable police force who, you know, and there's lots of good people in the police force who are doing their best to fight crime in one thing and the other. But this idea that they're there to represent corporate interests is absolutely unacceptable, and it leads to corruption.
Well, Martin hinted there, and we're going to hear a bit about this now, that there has also been revelations of a serious organised crime agency report from 3 or 4 years ago that's been sitting on the shelf, that private investigators, in collaboration with police officers at the Metropolitan Police, were actually deleting evidence from computers and altering files on the Metropolitan Police's computers. So let's have a listen now to Channel 4's Andy Davis report on that very issue.
At the heart of the whole phone hacking scandal has been the name of one man in particular, Glenn Mulcair. He was the private investigator who specialised in phone hacking, who, with the knowledge of the news of the world, dialed into the personal lives of so many public and hitherto private figures, with such apparent ease and with such momentous consequences. This has always been a scandal involving rogue PIs and tabloid journalism. But what about the links other private investigators have had to organised crime? This is a story about deleting intelligence, trying to get witness names, infiltrating police operations and corrupt cops. A story which, as we can now reveal, was told privately by the serious organised crime agency SOCA to the Home Office 4 years ago. It came in the form of a confidential 8-page report, the details of which have never been disclosed publicly before. You can't access it through the Freedom of Information Act, but I've now been shown a copy. And what is so alarming about this report is not what it says about the threat posed by private investigators to people's privacy. It's what it says about the very serious threat some private investigators have posed to the criminal justice system. The confidential report by SOCA is dated January 2008, and it warns about unscrupulous members of the private investigation industry providing specialist services to serious organised criminals. SOCA analysed 5 law enforcement operations under what they called Project Riverside. 2 operations they discovered showed private investigators involved in the following: accessing the police national computer to perform unauthorised checks, accessing internal police databases, including those containing serving officers' private details, accessing details of current investigations against a criminal or criminal group, and deleting intelligence records from law enforcement databases. And for that to have happened, they would have needed the help of corrupt serving police officers. Some industry representatives suggest that nearly half of all private investigators in the UK are former police officers. In 2008, as Channel 4 News can now reveal, SOCA was warning that private investigators had been providing organised crime groups with counter-surveillance techniques attempting to discover the identity of Chizzes, covert human intelligence sources or informants, even attempting to discover the location of witnesses under police protection to intimidate them. How many criminal investigations were compromised as a result? How many, if any, identities of informants and witnesses were uncovered by private investigators? The Home Office and SOCA declined to respond to these questions today. The Home Office had this document about police corruption and private investigators 4 years ago, and it had a stark warning inside it. The ability of the investigators, it said, to commit such criminality is supported by the absence of regulation. That absence of any form of regulation endures to this day.
That was the Andy Davis's report from Channel 4 News a little while ago. I think it was actually end of last week, that report. Martin, we've got a pretty scary situation here. If I was a detective working at the Metropolitan Police and I'd spent 3 or 4 months in a very dangerous inquiry putting together evidence that may be then used in a criminal prosecution, I turn up on the Monday morning and I find that all that information has been deleted off the computer system. What am I supposed to do then?
Well, I suppose the procedure is that you start to find out who did that and try and get them caught. And, you know, corruption in the police, what we have to accept, is inevitable because of the kind of people policemen deal with. And there's always going to be a problem with it, and you've always got to keep very vigilant if you're going to keep it out. But, of course, some people don't want to be vigilant about it because they are making money out of it, you know.
But surely there are aspects of the police service that are designed to look at criminality in the police, yeah. Identify criminal policemen. We had something a few years ago called Operation Countryman, didn't we, which successfully accused and actually jailed several policemen for doing things like planting evidence.
Yeah. Well, I talked to a South African friend of mine. He said that they used to have an elite police squad in South Africa called the Scorpions, who looked at other police officers. They were then infiltrated by organised crime, so an even more secret squad had to be set up to investigate the first squad, and then a third squad had to be set up to investigate the second squad, because that's what police work is like, and proper coppers know it.
There was also, I think, Sir Paul Condon speaking to the Home Affairs Select Committee back, must be about 7 or 8 years ago now, saying that there were between 100 and 250 corrupt Scotland Yard officers. I mean, how can we be in a situation where corruption, and it seems pretty clear that that's what we're talking about here, is allowed to carry on in Scotland Yard and there is nobody actually going to investigate
it? What Condon actually said was, the bad news is, folks, we've got the, you know, 120 corrupt officers. The good news is we know which ones they are and we've got our eye on them, but of course they can't get rid of them very easily because they're trained police officers. They know how to cover their tracks, and that's one of the problems.
John, it's a bit of a sticky problem, this, and particularly difficult if you're a policeman who's doing a dangerous investigation of some sort, and then finding that the evidence is simply being deleted off your computer. It's very bad for morale, and it's almost a sort of pat on the back for the bad guys.
I'm absolutely certain that people who go into the police as going to any form of public service want to do their best, and they find themselves in, as Martin has said, a very difficult environment. But I do come back to this point about democracy and accountability, and I think it's about what type of police force we actually want. I mean, I'm not familiar enough with this story to make any particular comment on it, but what is required in terms of the police as well as anywhere else is a proper public service ethos. And what's going wrong in this country is that it's been ripped to shreds again by ideology. I'm sorry to repeat that word, because what we're beginning to see is the beginnings of an increase in private security industry, and I think that's impacting on the police as well, and I think it opens up the potential for criminality, opens up the potential for corruption. So I think we need a really serious debate about what kind of policing that we want, because I think for a lot of people they see it as an area over which they have no control, and I think that's very dangerous. I also think this country, there's a situation becoming increasingly sharp where people feel that there's one law for us and another law for them. And I don't mean the police, I mean the people in the establishment. During the riots, I mean, it's with absolute shock you see that people were sent to prison for 6 months for stealing a bottle of water. and people have been sent to prison for posting on Facebook. And yet we see at the top of the establishment, whether it be the Murdoch or certain people, the head of the police force, who seem to be able to get away with anything they like without any kind of restraint or without any kind of comeback. And I think that's what makes people angry. So we need accountability, we need democracy.
Martin, you've talked quite a bit about potential fraud in the city as well, and the way that the banks, if they're fraudulent banks and they get away with it, then the whole of the banking system has to adopt that policy in order to keep up.
It's the Enron factor.
But if corruption is not dealt with, it grows like a cancer. How to deal with something like this? Something you mentioned, the scorpions in South Africa.
This crisis is also an opportunity, because they keep saying, "Oh, if you raise taxes on us, we'll just disappear to the Cayman Islands." You won't if you're in prison and we've confiscated all of your assets. In the 1930s in America, thousands of bankers were put in prison by Roosevelt. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan put hundreds of bankers in prison. So far, we've not seen one in prison. That's what ought to happen after a crisis like this. You expect to see, you know, thousands of people going sent down and all their assets confiscated. But and that covers your deficit.
I would suggest to you that David Cameron and George Osborne are not the sort of people who are likely to institute in the Queen's Speech a new law to deal with the bankers.
They don't need a new law. They just need to enforce the existing ones. And that's the problem.
This is what that chap from the SFO, Serious Fraud Office, was saying, is that there should be even more laws.
Well, to be honest with you, they don't enforce the ones that exist. And if they enforced the ones that exist, then you and I know, Tony, that the senior Tory leadership are implicated in buying and selling South African nuclear weapons for personal profit. We're getting inside information about that, and we've been talking about it on the show. I mean, that's all criminal behaviour, and they could all be sent down and all their assets confiscated. And we've got a list of top Tories who had their fingers in the till.
Okay, thank you. On to our next story. Tax credit changes mean a bleak Friday. That's today, Good Friday, but not for some, as there are thousands of more poor families. Around 212,000 working couples with children will lose roughly £4,000 a year through changes that don't even simplify the system. That's the thousands of the poorest working families in Britain are losing £4,000 a year through changes to the tax credits introduced today. While the Institute for Fiscal Studies calculated that up to 850,000 families, including many from the squeezed middle, so-called squeezed middle, will lose all their child tax credit worth at least £545. Those on the lowest incomes will be hit much harder. An estimated 212,000 working couples with children who earn less than £17,000 a year will lose all their working tax credit. Now, John, this is actually a disincentive to work, because it means that many of these families will be better off on benefits.
Well, it's a disincentive to work, but you see, the fact of the matter here is what's happened under the guise of driving through the welfare bill. Cameron and Osborne have sought to divide people, unemployed from employed workers, be saying that this welfare bill is about tackling people who don't want to work, etc., etc. I'll maybe address that in a moment. But the real point here is, under the guise of that, they've driven through an end to universal benefits, and they've driven through these caps on tax credits. And which means that, I won't go through the figures again, it means that millions of people in this country who are in work, who are low-paid workers, will in fact be hit by these changes. So that is why, you know, my union has been absolutely clear in terms of the welfare bill, the Welfare Act, is that these attacks are absolutely unacceptable. Again, I referred to earlier that they are removing the safety net for millions of people on benefit. But what they're also doing is driving those who are already in low pay, those who are already struggling in the midst of an economic crisis that didn't create, further and further into debt and further into a situation where they're finding it more and more difficult to cope. So it's absolutely unacceptable.
Martin, an estimated 212,000 working couples with children who earn less than £17,000 a year will lose all their working tax credits, that is worth around about £4,000 annually.
Well, I mean, the other point I'd make about this is, as you cut away at people's benefits, what you're doing is sawing off the branch you're sitting on in terms of the economy. What happens in a poor area when benefits get cut? Oh, the little shops close, and then the shop is out of business and somebody else is on benefit.
Well, that's good for Tesco's, though, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not good for... ultimately, the problem in the economy is lack of demand. the rich don't spend enough on yachts to keep us all in business. And the most, what you should do in a situation like this where the economy's wobbling is you should double unemployment benefit. That's what you should do, and that gives the economy a bounce. So as people fall into unemployment, they bounce back again because they've got some money, and the economy runs along.
Well, I think there's a number of myths around welfare, and I would, again, I don't like using this language. What's actually been going on in this country? It started under Labour, by the way, is what could only be described as a hate campaign against people on benefits, and actually against those who deliver it as well. It was summed up by one woman on the demonstration for disabled people in London last year, who said, "We used to be poor dears, now we are benefit cheats." And there's a lot, and it's based on mythology, the idea that people are shirkers, that they simply don't want to work. Well, in reality, there's 5 million people unemployed in this country at the present time, so there are no jobs. There's a mythology about benefits being generous. Now, in reality, who wants to live on £65 a week? And I think I've made that point about fraud earlier, that there's £16 billion in unclaimed benefit. So, but the point that Martin makes is actually very important in terms of the economy. That my union, who were derided for this, by the way, at the time, we were described as deficit deniers, said that instead of these cuts being driven through, what you need is an alternative based in tax justice. You know, not very sort of a wacky idea that we pay our taxes and rich people should pay their taxes too, which rather than cutting jobs, there should be investment. And that includes investment in the public sector, incidentally, because every time a job goes in the public sector, one, probably two, and sometimes three actually goes in the private sector.
It's all very
well.
Well to talk about investment, John, but where's this money going to come from?
The money the money can come from a number of sources. Taxing the rich, for example, would be one way of doing it, or even get them to pay the tax that they already owe to the tune of £130 billion. I mean, that would be a start, the fact that they would pay tax the same as the rest of us. But, you know, we have a situation, as I say, where the big corporations, people with loads of money, just don't want to spend it, don't want to invest it at the at the present time. You could have a programme of kickstarting the building industry by building the council houses, the 1 million council houses it's needed for the 4 million people in this country who need council housing. You could create a million climate jobs to deal with the problems of global warming, which would again be helpful in terms of the building industry. It's about stimulating the economy. Now, none of this is radical socialism, by the way. This is used to be called what is called basic Keynesianism, and that's exactly the point I was going to make. 20 years ago, this would just have been described as common sense, but good economic sense. That's what Roosevelt done during the 1930s. It's what governments have done. We are described as extremists for putting this forward. So we're living in an unreal world at the present time, where basic common sense is treated as extremism, and cutting the public services up is considered to be good sense. It's crazy.
Martin, are we really sort of just failing to face up to the fact that Britain is no longer an industrial power? I mean, John's just talking about 5 million people unemployed. I mean, those people, you know, back in the 1960s, 70s, all used to be working because we were a major industrial power. Isn't there a sort of failure to face up to the fact that we're not a major industrial power, that the big industry is actually going on in China? Shipbuildings closed down.
We need to think laterally about where we stand in the world. I mean, one of the things that the Green Party has put forward, and I agree with, is we could have, for example, a citizen's income, so that everybody just gets, say, £150 a week for being a British citizen, and they can work on top of that. Yeah. So that takes your poverty trap away straight away, because people, instead of being harassed by the benefit fraud officers, if they can get an hour's work, they can get an hour's work. It flexibilises the labour.
Well, what you're saying, even the super rich should get an extra £150.
What will happen for them? The super rich, they won't even notice that they've got £150 a week. Give it to everybody.
Well, it's like the argument of universal benefits. I mean, the Tories say, well, there shouldn't be universal benefits. So, I mean, why should rich people get child benefit, etc.? Well, it's a very simple reason. You claw that back in tax. That's how you do it. There's nothing complicated about this, but what we have, Tony, in terms of this debate, is a situation that because that there's a crisis in political representation in this country, and the Tories, Labour, the Liberals, they all see no alternative to this kind of free market economics, and that is why very sensible suggestions on the economy are being driven to the margins. But when you put it to people that there is an alternative, they agree. It's just that the politicians who are in Parliament at the present time are not prepared to look at that alternative because they're completely and utterly tied to corporate interests.
I must admit, I'm always suspicious when anyone says to me there is no alternative. OK, well, anyway, on to our next story. And the Royal British Legion saying to Ken Clark, drop your monstrous secret hearings now. Well, it's not often that the Royal British Legion roars, but when it does, it's quite interesting. The bereaved armed forces families will benefit from challenging to Ken Clark's monstrous plan to create secret inquests, the Royal British Legion said. The Justice Secretary's arrogant and reckless plans to hide military inquests behind a veil of national security are a perversion of justice and must be stopped, the nation's leading armed forces charity said in a statement. Bereaved armed forces families must not be cut out of inquests into their loved ones' deaths, it added. The nation's fallen heroes and their families deserve better, Martin.
Well, full marks to the Royal British Legion. They are right and Ken Clark is wrong.
I think it's as simple as that. I mean, it's absolutely grotesque that people who go to serve their country, whether you agree with wars or not, the fact of the matter is that they then have inquests which are secret. And this is part and parcel of a government that likes to talk about everything should be open, you know, everything should be you know, open for inspection. They're now, and Cameron's having to retreat from this, actually, you know, talking about a secret courts and access to people's emails and the right to snoop on people's emails and internet traffic. They are grotesque.
Clark had earlier accused the British Legion of believing conspiracy theories about the proposed changes which would allow court hearings into military deaths to be held in secret. Evidently, said the Legion, the conspiracy theory is also believed by the Deputy Prime Minister, an influential cross-party committee of MPs, and expert groups such as Inquest, Liberty and Reprieve, the Legion added. It's time that Ken Clark stopped hiding behind empty rhetoric and dropped these dangerous plans. Martin, finally, what could be the motive of Ken Clark in keeping these things secret?
Think about that Chinook crash in the Isle of Mull a few years ago, where all the top anti-IRA Cywar boys were killed in one go. They don't want to fight. What was that all about? And what was that all about? Good question. And it may be to do with the Chinook helicopter itself or something more sinister. What about that crash of the plane in Afghanistan, the Nimrod? What happens is, you see, the arms companies cut corners to make profits. And that's why you have to have proper open inquests, because otherwise people die.
This is the thing, isn't it? If you haven't got an open inquest, you're never going to find out what was actually behind a particular death. You're never going to make sure
Obviously, there's you do need secrets in military matters, but you want to keep secret the things that you really need to keep secret.
Justice in all its forms should be open, it should be transparent, and it should be accessible. It really is as simple as that. You move away from those basic principles and you end up in a very, very difficult situation.
Incidentally, Ken Clark is one of those named as having his fingers in the till about South African nuclear weapons, which were bought in 1991.
Yeah, he's quite an interesting figure, Clark, because he was actually the chairman of British American Tobacco for a long time, wasn't he?
Yeah, but we're getting information he was actually a criminal.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that he was then health secretary, which is a bit of a bizarre transformation under Margaret Thatcher, and his first appearance as health secretary was in a John Player special sports car, which makes you wonder, well, smoking and car accidents are the biggest causes of death around.
I know that's what he's mainly known for, but the kind of information we're getting is that he's actually bent. You know, he's actually taken...
Well, as you know, Martin, I do a website about the Bilderbergers, the Bilderberg Steering Committee, the British representative on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, which is a very secretive, very powerful organisation, people that control most of the money in the Western world, from the central banks to royalty to the oil companies. And Ken Clark is the British representative on the Steering Committee of this secretive organisation.
Yeah. I mean, all of those things are true, but we have specific information, including about David Cameron, that they are in fact criminals. You've got specific information about that.
Okay, well, if you want to hear about that, you can go onto our archives with Martin waxing lyrical about the South African David Cameron nuclear alleged plot. Anyway, on to the mayor story, and an official no campaign has been launched against an elected mayor for Bristol. The official no campaign against the mayor for Bristol was launched with claims the role would damage the city. But it's also apparently vital for Bristol to have an elected mayor. One of Bristol's leading businessmen has claimed it's vital for the city to have an elected mayor if it's to have any hope of being great once again. Michael Bottomley was speaking at the annual get-together of the city's Chamber of Commerce, Business West. Mr. Bottomley is a senior partner at the law firm Beechcroft, was giving his final speech as president at the organisation's annual dinner. The Chamber is one of the most influential business organisations in the city, and Mr. Bottomley has held the position for the last 3 years. He's also part of the delegation which travelled to Downing Street this week to talk about the issue of elected mayors with David Cameron. The Prime Minister has made his support of the concept of an elected mayor clear and has also revealed that cities who do have an elected mayor will have a direct link to central government and meetings directly with the Prime Minister. John, any thoughts about this whole elected mayor campaign? Because we've heard a bit of news yesterday from central government saying that they're now not going to pay for the leaflet which has been posted through almost all the doors in the city explaining this referendum because they believe it's biased.
Well, I haven't read that leaflet. I did read the story, so I'm not quite sure. So I'm not really qualified to comment on that, but I will read the leaflet. But you see, I just think this stuff about elected mayors is a complete and utter irrelevance and could turn out to be an expensive irrelevance. What the real issue in this country is, and the real issue in Bristol, is that we want people in politics who are going to represent the views of ordinary people. And it's not just about voting. If we have a situation where all the main parties are saying the same things, what we have is a crisis of political representation. That's what we have at the present time. I've lived in England for the greater part of my adult life. So, but in Scotland at the present time, there's a real debate going on about independence. Now, I don't want to get into it. I just want to make a simple point about that. Is that right at the core of that debate? And it's not always. I don't think it's always visible to people, but it is a real issue about democracy, is that people feel as if that whatever they say is ignored, that they have no access to power in the sense that control over their own lives. And I think that's one of the reasons that the independence movement in Scotland will grow over the course of the next year or two. But that impacts on everybody across the United Kingdom, and in people in Bristol. I think this stuff about mayors is really just a gimmick because the political system is so absolutely unresponsive to what people need. And that is why I believe that the type of campaigns run by my union and other people in the trade union movements and are more relevant to people's lives. And if you want to know that this election of Galloway in the Bradford, now whatever you think about George Galloway, the reality is that the establishment don't know how to handle it. They're talking about he's appealing to the Muslim vote, etc, etc. In reality, the greater part of his campaign was against the austerity programme, and he won votes from right across the whole of the community in Bradford. I think people want genuine democracy, they don't want gimmicks.
Martin, the argument here really is that a mayor would be a sort of lightning rod, political lightning rod, which would greatly ease change because the political system many people see as a sort of ossified, kind of fossilised, and it's really resistant to any kind of change.
Yes, one city, one folk, one leader, the Führer Prinzip. So let's not have a committee where everybody's views are heard. Let's just have one wizard guy to run everything. Where did we hear that before?
Well, there's also the other sort of counter-argument being that we've just heard from South Gloucestershire, for example, news that the councillors there have decided to actually reject the cabinet system. And this is, in a way, the mayor system is in a way, a sort of even more super cabinet system with one person making decisions about how policy is dealt with rather than even a small committee, a cabinet, an executive, if you want. So it seems that South Gloucestershire is almost going in the opposite direction.
You know why that is, because they felt that the cabinet system was leading to corruption. Because, of course, if you want to corrupt just one guy, it's a lot easier than corrupting a whole committee, isn't it?
Okay, well, we will find out in May whether Bristol wants or does not want an elected mayor. Now, on to our next story. And a doctor's dismissed concern over private health links. This is in the Somerset Guardian. This is in the Somerset Guardian. The leader of a group of GPs who will be at the helm of Bath and North East Somerset's health services from next year has dismissed fears that some of them will have divided loyalties. Five of the family doctors who sit on the board of the body, which will be buying £280 million of healthcare for the area, are also involved in a partnership with Virgin Care, which charges the NHS for some health services. A TUC-funded research group, False Economy, has suggested the links with Virgin Care might cause complications, but Bath and North East Somerset Clinical Commissioning Group, the CCG, and its counterparts around the country are waiting for regulations from the government about how the regime will operate from March 2013. Now, the Health and Social Care Bill, John McInally from the PCS Union, this is going to be implemented next year, even though it's just been passed into law, and it seems already there are some serious allegations of conflicts of interest, and doctors in Bath who are having to say, well, actually, we don't think there is a conflict of interest, even though we have an interest in private healthcare, and we are deciding how the public money is spent.
I think that the bill that which is now an act, I think that you've referred to, tells me that Cameron and Osborne are not really too fixated in whether or not they're actually re-elected, because they've tried to do everything they can to grab as much of the public sector and privatise it. I think people need to be clear that this means a full privatisation of the National Health Service, and it will, in the course of years, if it's allowed to be bedded in, I think, by the way, we should continue to fight against it. I don't see this as a done deal by any stretch of the imagination. It's essentially taking taxpayers' money, which they would freely give in order to have proper healthcare, and handing it over to multimillionaires who are going to come in, asset strip, who are going to impose the lowest possible standards and just going to grab the money and run. It is an absolute outrage, and I think from that point of view it will mean that what we've taken for granted over the course since the Second World War, really, you know, the access to proper health care is going to mean that people will die, that people won't have access not just to minor medical procedures but to serious issues as well. And I think from that point of view, our message would be we continue to campaign against this. But really, the whole question of privatisation, you know, we should call it for what it is. It is organised theft. It is taking money from the taxpayer, which the Tories always talk about, and handing it over to those who will stuff into their bank accounts.
But the argument, John, is that actually it's cheaper.
It's not cheaper. It is absolutely, any serious study tells you that delivery by the public sector is actually cheaper. It is one of the great lies that has become received wisdom. And it's quite easy to work out. I mean, let me give you an example on this A4E controversy that's going on at the present time in terms of workfare and so on. Now, the person who's the head of that company, who used to be Cameron's government czar, had to resign just a while back because her company is involved in, let's just say it's been, I wouldn't put things as strongly
allegations,
as
allegations of fraud,
there's allegations of criminal behaviour, so we'll wait and see what comes out of that. But this was an area of work delivered efficiently and effectively by civil servants, which has been put into the private sector. We have an individual who is now a multimillionaire who lives in luxury. I mean, that's her words, not mine. And every penny has come from the taxpayer. Now, that tells you why it's more expensive to do it through the privatisation. That's one simple reason.
Martin, all six GPs who make up the board of Bath and North East Somerset CCG work at surgeries which are members of a local GP Virgin Care partnership called Assura Minerva. It provides fracture clinics, private minor surgery and help for those with deep vein thrombosis, amongst other services. A spokesman for NHS Bath and North East Somerset PCT insisted that GP board members would not be involved in decisions which could see a firm in which they have an interest being awarded a contract. However, this would mean all six GPs would be barred from voting on any tender that Assura Minerva was bidding for, raising serious questions about the CCG's ability to make a decision. Assura Minerva, incidentally, was part of Assura Medical, which recently changed its name to Virgin Care. A Virgin Care spokesman confirmed that whilst a few of their 25 joint ventures with GPs put their profits back into patient care, others do not.
Well, what about the good old days when doctors were doctors and worried about illness? This is just absurd. Doctors are not trained to do this stuff. They've got A-levels coming out of their ears in things like chemistry and so on, but they're not businessmen or women. It's a completely ridiculous way to proceed.
But you're not actually addressing the issue here, which is about potential conflict of interest.
Yes, there will be conflicts of interest once you go down this road. You're bound to have conflicts of interest. So why can't doctors just get on being doctors and the National Health Service administrators administer the system?
I mean,
simple.
The argument here is that they're going to be making decisions about vast sums of public money that may go to their own companies.
Well, indeed. And that's what private doctors do, and it's what private doctors in the United States do. But British doctors were famous for being doctors, and that's what they just used to be. We've had a doctor on here the other week saying, "I don't want to be a business person. I'm a doctor. That's why I went into medicine to look after people and help them."
Another story on the NHS, the Fairness Czar has been urged to quit by doctors over a conflict of interest following £800,000 payment for a US private health giant. The head of the NHS regulator that's meant to ensure fairness when private sector firms bid for public contracts is also the chairman of a huge company whose health service business is worth £80 million a year and set to increase massively. As the chairman of the NHS Cooperation and Competition Panel, Lord Carter, of Coles, is paid £60,000 for 2 days work a week, but his other role as chairman of the UK branch of the American healthcare firm McKesson is more generously rewarded. Last year he got £800,000 for that.
It goes back to a very simple point. It's about the public service ethos. If you believe it's a good thing to serve the public in whatever, whether it be the police or the civil service or you know, NHS, then there are standards of behaviour. But if the view coming from the top politicians, whether it be Blair, whose view this was, or Cameron, is it just go out and do whatever the hell you like, it's all about making money, it's about dog eat dog, then this is what will happen. People will think it's all right to behave like that. And that is why I think we have to have an alternative, not just in terms of economics, but an alternative in terms of standards and the way we behave. So there's nothing unusual about this. I don't find it shocking. I just, it's an inevitable consequence of dog eat dog and only money talks.
Martin, do you want to say something about that? Because this is quite amazing that this guy is getting £800,000 a year from a US private health giant, and yet he's supposed to be in charge of fairness in the awarding of contracts in the NHS.
You couldn't make this stuff up, could you? I mean, Tom Lehrer said it when Kissinger got the Peace Prize, he'd have to give up satire. I mean, fairness guy, he's a fairness czar, and he's on £800,000 a year. I hope many people listening to this programme are not on a lot less than that. What do you think about that in Radio Land? £800,000 a year for being a fairness czar. What a joke.
Okay, and our final story for the week, it's goodbye to the Clevedon Mercury. After more than 150 years, what was the Clevedon Mercury was published for the last time this week. Former editor Carol Deacon said, "It's sad, but I'm glad it wasn't on my watch that the award-winning newspaper renamed to tie in with the successful local people websites meets its demise." John McAnally, this is within a region which is, as newspaper wise, is pretty much controlled by Northcliffe, which is the regional newspaper arm of the Daily Mail. Newspaper had been going for 150 years. And what Northcliffe are saying, apparently, is that, that actually the people around there will simply buy the Western Daily Press rather than have a dedicated Clevedon newspaper.
Well, I think it's always a shame to see newspapers going down. I mean, I'm not familiar with the Clevedon Mercury, I have to say, but I'm not quite sure what kind of newspaper it was other than the local one, but it's sad to see a newspaper going down.
Okay, and they're of course making massive profits, and that is really their monopoly position that enables them to do